science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Sikowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dog, Bunsen. He's the Twitter science dog. This show takes what's best about dog Twitter, the fun and the empathy found there, but also swirls it together with science and education. Every week, we'll take a deep dive into some interesting thing happening in science in the world, as well as look into the world of science around pets. We also have an expert on every single episode that we have an exciting chat with about what they're studying and the impacts for our society. This is the Science Podcast. Hello, folks. Welcome to the Science Podcast for yet another week. If you're listening to this on Thursday, the day the podcast drops, we have one day left in school in Alberta, and then it is summer holidays. The kids were done last week, but we've had this week as teachers to gather the marks the kids have been doing for online learning. Beaker continues to grow like a weed. She is adorable. And we're still so proud of Bunsen, how he is doing so great to welcome the little dog into our household. It's not that exciting, but I did get a haircut. My students didn't want me to get a haircut until the end of school. And boy, did my hair get really long. I had a record of about 22 pencils I could stick in my hair and make them disappear. On the Science Podcast this week in science news, we're going to be talking about a two-legged ancient creature. I'm not going to give too much away, but it was pretty terrifying. We got a really cute dog science article to talk about. And our guest in Ask an Expert is Dr. Keith Barr, who specializes in metabolism and exercise. So as we're all coming, well, for some of us, coming out of this shelter in place, it's a really great episode to think about health and exercise. Hey, Bunsen, why did the gym close down? It wasn't working out. Or because of COVID. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to talk a little bit about an ancient creature that has a little bit of a connection to a guest we had on last season. Elizabeth Bourgeois was a guest in season one, and we talked to her about crocodiles and forensic accounting. It's a great episode. She's such a crazy cool person. Her husband and herself help move crocodiles that get into the wrong place. And little baby ones are super adorable. The big ones are kind of dangerous. And when they know how to do it, they're trained. And one of the things we learned from them, from our chat, is that crocodiles are ancient. They are super, super old. Not so much that they live old, just that they haven't changed that much in the millions of years since the time of the dinosaurs. They're pretty much a perfect evolutionary machine. Scientists are studying their immune system and blood, among other things, because they rarely, if ever, get cancer. And they have injuries from fighting each other and trying to bite other animals. And they live in these bogs, in these marshes, which are just, you know, cesspools of bacteria and infection. And they never seem to get infected. So why are we talking about crocodiles? Well, here's the story. There were some fossil records preserved in South Korea that seemed to show that ancient ancestors of our crocodiles walked on two legs. That's terrifying. The tracks were found in a very fossil-rich area called the Jinju Formation, not to be confused with Jianyu, if you watch The Good Place. And that's where, you know, it's a very fossil-rich area, and they found lots of different animals, including dinosaurs. These fossils are from crocodile morphs. Yes, that's a thing. Crocodile morphs. How old are these fossils? They are pegged around 106 million years ago. So, you know, not a little bit longer than just yesterday. And these crocodile morphs are about 2 to 3 meters long. So not that different in size from full-grown crocodiles of today, except they walked on two legs. This article is from Scientific Report. So what's the background here? Well, it's very tough to identify footprints of dinosaurs and the animal that makes it unless the animal dies. Like, it's walked its last walk and kind of, like, keels over. And then our paleontologists can work their way backwards and say, oh, okay, this animal was here. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Oh, okay, yeah, that was its kind of last little steps, and we figured it out. Short of finding an animal, it's very, very, very difficult. And there's always uncertainty if the footprints are from the animal they think it is. These footprints were super well preserved. And the lead paleontologist of this study, Martin Lockley, said that because of the perfect preservation, they could attribute these footprints to Batrachopus, which is one of these crocodilomorphs. And they had dozens of them. Now, how did they know that this crocodile thing walked on two legs? Well, none of the footprints had front feet. They were all back legs. So think like, I don't know, a T-Rex walking or a Velociraptor. They don't use their front legs. They're only going to be leaving behind back-legged footprints. This helps solve a bit of a puzzle that the same team was missing from a find in 2012. A bunch of very weird footprints that might have been pterosaurs, which are those winged reptiles that lived among the dinosaurs. But they're pretty sure pterosaurs are quadrupedal. So they would, when they landed, they would walk on all fours. They wouldn't like, hop about like a pigeon or something. I don't know, like a parrot. But the new tracks are the first that hint that crocodile ancestors walked on two legs. These animals lived up to 231 million years ago. And where could they have lived? All over the world. North Carolina is a good bet based on other evidence. Now, this is a relatively short story because they're working their way backwards from this footprint, these footprints without front feet that fit some of the feet skeleton. The feet skeletons of these ancient crocodiles. So while this article is short, one of the cool things about these ancient animals is that they are just bizarre compared to things that we know today. Can you imagine? I can't. But you're by a swamp, and then you're like, oh, it's a crocodile. But it gets up on back legs and runs after you. Okay, that's terrifying. And I'm sorry to give you nightmares, but that's science news for this week. This week in pet science, we're going to talk about some things that humans do that bamboozle dogs. If you've been following the social media that we've been posting on Bunsen and Beaker's accounts, we bamboozled Beaker with a lemon, and she was kind of weirded out by a water hose. So as puppies grow, there's some things that really puzzle them. And I know Bunsen's an adult dog now, but there are some times he looks and he's like, what is going on? But we're going to take a broader look at things that humans do that really confuse dogs from experts. Melissa Starling is a postdoctoral researcher from the University of Sydney, and Paul McGreevy is a professor of animal behavior. They came together and they kind of co-authored a quick little point form article about some things that humans do that really confuse dogs. And the first one is that we leave them alone. So dogs are very social, right? Puppies are super interested in spending time with everybody, other dogs, other people. Not all puppies, Beaker definitely. Beaker loves Bunsen. She follows Bunsen everywhere. She loves us. She follows us everywhere. Well, I don't know if she loves us yet, but she follows us everywhere. She follows me because I have treats. When we leave dogs at home, they have a very different, or, you know, at a vet, they have a very different understanding of time. And from the studies they've done with dogs, one of the conclusions is that dogs may not know, unless they've been eased into it, that we'll ever return to get them. And that's really heartbreaking when you think of it. Another thing that's really confusing for them is when we leave them alone or we don't let them into places. It's something they have to learn. It's very confusing for them. That's why sometimes it's really tough to tell dogs they can't go certain places in your house, because they're part of your family and they go with you everywhere, and it's very confusing. They're like, why can't I come with you? And they may not be able to put two and two together that it's the area they're not allowed to go in. It's just like, why can't I be with you? Some dogs are very family driven and are not well suited to being a solitary animal outside, unless they've got some friends. We read that about Bernese Mountain Dogs, that Bernese Mountain Dogs are very family oriented. So unless you've got a couple more dogs for them to roam about with outside, if you kind of kick them outside without being around the family all the time, it can really damage their mental state. And we all know Goldens love everybody. I'm not saying if you have a Bernese Mountain Dog or a Golden and they're an outside dog that they've gone crazy. I'm just saying they're very people-friendly people dogs. Dogs are also kind of bamboozled by our lack of smell because they don't understand that humans see things through vision. It takes a bit for them to understand that the visual cue means something that they're supposed to do because so much of their life revolves around smell. And some dogs are better smellers than others. I would hazard a guess that Golden Retrievers are better smellers than Bernese Mountain Dogs because Beaker is running circles around Bunsen with the smelling powers. There's just some things she can pick up on there's no way Bunsen ever cared about before. Another thing they talked about that's very confusing for a dog is that we actually manipulate our smell and what we look like. And dogs rarely do that. Dogs, when they do it, it's to leave, you know, give their pack a message. So when we clean ourselves, like having showers and things like that, we go from smelling one way to smelling another. Also hats and hoodies are very challenging for some dogs to get around. And we found that with Bunsen. Bunsen is good with men 9 times out of 10. But the 1 time out of 10 where he is very leery of them, especially around our property, is if they're wearing a hat or if they're wearing a hoodie. It's like it's not a human to him, it's a threat. And we talked before, it's probably because we had an intruder when he was 9, 10 months that was in a hoodie and wearing a hat. And we had to call the police and I was shouting at this guy to get out of there. So that could be related as well. One thing I was really shocked to know is that dogs don't necessarily like to get hugged. Dogs can't really hug each other. So they're not really evolved to show affection in that matter. They can jump and grab with their teeth and their forelimbs when they're wrestling. But they don't like to be pinned for long. In fact, if a dog gets pinned for too long, you can see their anxiety and anger flare. So it takes a bit of practice to teach a dog to be hugged. And even then, some dogs don't like to be hugged. Beaker is a hugger. She already likes to be hugged and to be held close. Could be because she's a puppy. Could be because she's a Golden. Bunsen is selective when he wants hugs. He loves giving kids hugs. And he's kind of hit and miss with me. If he's tired, he's super cuddly. And when I haven't been around for a while, he's super cuddly. But if he's like just randomly on the floor and I go up and give him a hug, he's like, why? And he'll like put up with it because he's a good dog and then he'll peace out. One last thing that was really cute about the study, and it was mentioned actually by the dog trainer that we took Bunsen to and we're hoping to take Beaker to as well. She's a smart lady. Her name's Char. She runs a thing in town called Waggles. It's adorable. Anyways, what these animal behaviorists also said is that our hands to dogs, until they kind of figure us out, are super weird because our hands are like two mouths to a dog. Our hands do everything. Like we grab, we move, and dogs use their mouths for pretty much what we use our hands for. So if you're ever playing with a puppy, that's why puppies like to attack your hands, as they see your hand as a mouth. And when you're going to greet a dog, an open hand could be terrifying. Like that's why people sometimes get bit by normally very friendly dogs or dogs that have never attacked somebody before. You go reaching for a dog's head with an outstretched hand. It can be very, very intimidating. It's people in the know call it being hand shy. You might see videos, you might see behaviorists talk about petting with the back of your hand or like with your forearm. So there's no, it looks like a dog arm as opposed to a human hand. And we're finding that with Beaker. Man, my hand is so bit up. We need to work on bite inhibition. And we are with her. The good thing is that having Bunsen is slowing her bite inhibition down. Bunsen was way worse. Man, we were shredded from Bunsen. And we started bite inhibition way earlier than Beaker. And Beaker bites Bunsen all the time. And she's protecting us. So if you go after Beaker with your hand, she probably it's time to wrestle. So you got to watch out. She'll nip you. That's just a couple ways that human behaviors bamboozle our dogs. and that's Dog Science for this week. Before we get to the interview section, I just want to tell everybody a little bit about how the podcast is made possible. It's made possible, you can't see me pointing, but it's made possible by people just like you. If you've been listening to the show and you like the content, consider signing up on our Patreon page as a patron. The podcast, unfortunately, isn't free to run, even though we really enjoy doing it. It's been a great addition to our lives to share more in-depth science news than our Twitter accounts and definitely Instagram can allow. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/BunsenBurner, and there are four tiers of support. If you head over there, you can see the different monetary amounts, but the lowest one is only $5 a month. That's not that bad. We do about 4 or 5 shows a month. 4 shows, great education and entertainment for $5. Can't beat it. Plus, we send out perks. The other way the show makes money is through merchandise sales. We've worked with a cartoonist to deliver some amazingly adorable merchandise on our merchandise shop, and that's at www.BunsenBurnerBMD.com. The links are in the show notes, and you can peruse the adorable merchandise. Thanks, guys. Now on to the interview. On the Science Podcast, in the Ask an Expert section, I'm delighted to have Keith Barr, who is a molecular exercise physiologist. How are you doing today, Keith?
I'm doing great.
This interview will probably be airing a little bit after our chat. You teach at a university, is that correct?
Yes, I teach at the University of California, Davis. So it's one of the University of California sister universities, and basically it's the largest university in the world as the University of California, and we have 7 different campuses, and I teach at the Davis campus.
And that's all shut down, just like Canada, I imagine, because of COVID.
Yeah, it's completely shut down, and right now I'm teaching everything online. If people want to take my introductory to exercise and fitness course, they can just search on YouTube because I'm uploading the videos to YouTube, including my advanced course as well. That is a lot of advanced molecular biology, but anybody can take a look at it now because it's just has to be, you know, online. So I figured I may as well put it on YouTube in case anybody was interested.
I've been dumping all of my chemistry lessons, because I teach high school chemistry, on YouTube as well. And I'm cringing if anybody finds it, because I'm normally a really good planner and I stay like weeks ahead of my students. But with the switch to online, I'm like a day or two at most. So the stuff that goes on YouTube is not my best quality as a teacher, for sure. Are you finding that as well, or are you finding that you've been able to adapt to the online learning okay?
I've adapted okay. There are definitely the times where, because we're also moving house right now, so you have to take a lot of time to get something done at the new house, and then you realize that, oh yeah, I better upload my lectures, and then you're so you get into those situations, but you try and be good about it.
Yeah, I gotcha. So if you could explain to our listeners what your training and education is. We already talked that you do teach at a university. Mm-hmm. What's your training to be a molecular exercise physiologist?
So basically, most exercise physiologists are failed athletes, and I definitely qualify in that way. So I was good athlete, but never a great athlete. So I could work up to maybe, I got at best up to the provincial level as an athlete, but I never got to the national team or anything like that. So I wasn't going to make my living in that way. But I wanted to, like a lot of really average or but slightly above average athletes, you want to know why you're not a great athlete. And so you want to be able to blame physiology. So I started taking a lot of kinesiology courses when I went to the University of Michigan. And then together with being a strength and conditioning coach there for the football team and learning about the physiology of exercise, then I decided to do a master's at University of California at Berkeley, and then a PhD at the University of Illinois in Chicago, where I basically did a PhD on what is the molecular mechanism underlying why your muscles grow bigger when you do resistance exercise. So we discovered basically one molecule that your body turns on, and if you turn that molecule on a lot, you get a lot bigger muscle. And if you turn it on only a little because you haven't done as much work, you only get a slightly bigger muscle. And then I went on to this wonderful experience at the Washington University in St. Louis, where at one of the best medical schools in the world, I got an opportunity to work with a guy named John Halsey, who had been the first guy to discover that exercise, endurance exercise, was good for you, because he was a cardiologist. And up until he started doing research, people weren't sure whether exercise was good, because if they took a chest x-ray of a lifelong runner, it looked like a chest x-ray from somebody who was having heart failure. And so what he did is he discovered that, well, exercise was good because it increased longevity, but it also increased how well your muscle could use oxygen to make energy. And then with him, I helped discover basically a molecule that transduced, or was kind of the signal that you'd done a lot of endurance exercise. So it's the small molecule that actually goes in and starts increasing the production of those proteins that are important to make more mitochondria. And that's where you're going to produce the energy in the cell. So that's really what endurance exercise does. And so again, I've been really lucky to have those experiences. And then I went back to the University of Michigan to work with this guy who is what's called a tissue engineer. And he had figured out ways to engineer muscles in a dish, and he was using them to power little machinery.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was really cool. So I was like, okay, this would be great, because now I think I know everything about a muscle. So I'm going to be able to build these incredible muscles that are going to be able to control a couple of genes and make super muscles. And basically what usually happens is you're nowhere near as smart as you think you are. And so the idea of building super muscles was very kind of lived in my brain for maybe 2 years before I realized the limitations. And then we started to look at other things in the system, and we started to engineer little ligaments, because what we had realized is that one of the things that was problematic when you just make a muscle and you try and put it onto a robot to make the robot swim or do something cool is that it would always tear off the machine that you were putting it on right at the interface where you try to tie mm-hmm. it together. And so in our bodies, we have these things called tendons that connect muscles to bones. And so we figured that in order to make the connection better, we had to better understand what a tendon was. So we started engineering tendons, and so that's been an area of interest as well. And then from there, I got my first job, which is in Scotland at the University of Dundee, which is on the east coast of Scotland, right beside the North Sea.
Oh, very beautiful there, I bet.
Gorgeous area. It's a beautiful area. We had outstanding 5 years there where I started my first laboratory. I had great support from incredible students. And what we did there was a lot of really delving much deeper into how a lot of the systems that we study are being regulated. So how do we regulate our musculoskeletal function? So how do we regulate how well our muscles and tendons and bones work? And how can we improve that with our nutrition and with our exercise? And so that's really where we started to look at things like, how well can we make tendons work and ligaments work? And then about 11 years ago, I got this job at the University of California, Davis, where I've come and again had different opportunities, because Davis is probably the top agricultural school in the world, one of the top two or three, and it's a food science area. So now what we've been doing is looking to see what kind of foods are best for us when we want to try and increase our muscle size and strength as well. And so, you know, it's a long journey. As you've talked to a lot of academics, you know that they don't stay in one place for most of their lives. We travel quite a bit. And so we've been here for 11 years. We're probably going to be here for a while longer because we're moving into this new house. But it has been a journey.
Wow. Boy, just to unpack some of that exciting backstory might take another whole entire podcast. When you were young, you mentioned provincial. So you are originally from Canada.
Yeah, I grew up right outside of Toronto in a place called Burlington.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I know where that is. Yeah. One thing I was going to ask you is, like, what sports did you play, right? So if your journey to this started with sports, what did you play when you were young? So what was your thing?
Yeah, unlike most Canadians, I was not a hockey player. I actually was a basketball player.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I played kind of province level basketball. You know, I played through high school, did relatively well. And then when I went to the University of Michigan, I was like, maybe I'll try out for the team. And I was playing with some of the guys who were on the team. And I was like, oh, you know what? I've got the kind of same skill level as this guy here. Yeah, but he's 7'2" tall. And I'm guessing that I'm not going to have the same advantages that he has. And I always look at it like the reason that I wasn't able to be a basketball player at Michigan was that the year that I got there, they went on to win the national championship. So they really didn't need an average, moderate quality, 6'2" white guy to be a guard, you know? So
that's funny. See, that's exactly the same as me. I played basketball in high school. I didn't make it, you know, I didn't go on to play at any university or anything like that. But that was the thing I always tell kids is, and maybe we might get into it a bit with, you know, muscle development is in high school, there's kids who could just jump. They did no training and they could jump like crazy and dunk. Mm-hmm. And I was on the senior team and I trained at jumping. And by the end of my grade 12 year, I could sort of dunk. but
pretty similar. I was able to do the same. And I spent officially in, if you go back to the yearbook from my high school, the year that I was graduating, I was voted best friends with my basketball because you always have the best friends in the senior class are. And it was myself and my basketball. So that gives you an idea as to the amount of practice I did. A lot of jumping practice, a lot of other things. And yeah, I had the same thing. I could dunk on occasion, but it wasn't going to be spectacular. And I put in a whole lot more time than people who could outperform me on the court.
Yeah, that's funny. That's a story I always tell kids is that the one guy, he dunked and I was like, What do you do? Like, what do you wake up and you do plyometrics? Like, do you jump around and do weight training to dunk? And he's like, no, in grade 10, I just looked at the basketball hoop and I said to myself, I think I could dunk today. And I did.
Yeah. So you never judge or gauge your training on what other people do. I learned that when I was kind of a weight room flunky. And one of my friends there was coming home from, he was playing college football. And I was like, oh, so what exercises do you do for your back? And he goes, well, when I'm at college, I surf a lot. So, you know, all I do is I paddle out on my board and like, yeah, that's not going to happen. I'm in Southern Ontario. really not an area where there's a lot of surfing. So,
hey, one of the questions when you were talking, I just have a quick, maybe you could delve into it a bit. John Halsey, the cardiologist you worked with, you mentioned that you were looking at long distance runners. Was it their hearts? And then you found similarities with, what was it? Was it heart disease?
Yeah. So basically when Dr. Halsey started, he started at a time when people were taking pictures, x-rays of, and x-rays were really all they had at that time in the early to mid 1960s that people were using to try and kind of see a little bit of the physiology and what's happening in the body. And they were just taking x-rays of these people who were long distance runners, and they would always see that the heart was really big. And we know now that there's two types of big hearts. There's the big heart that you get when your heart doesn't work well because you've had a heart attack or you've had some sort of a problem with your heart, and your heart adapts by getting bigger, but it doesn't work very well. But we also know that endurance athletes like runners, their heart gets big, but it really works very well because it gets bigger in a slightly different way. And so, but when you only had a tool of an x-ray, there was this idea that, well, it doesn't look like it's good for you because it makes your heart like it's pathological, like it's diseased.
Thanks for clearing that up. Yeah, I was just curious about that. Did you and your research partner have any success in hooking the muscles with tendons on those little devices?
Yeah, so the guy that I worked with there is probably one of the smartest people I know, and he's outstanding. He's a guy named Robert Dennis, and he works now in North Carolina in the Research Triangle. He's a chair of one department that crosses the three universities there. And basically what he was doing was he actually, and there's videos you can go on if you search Robert Dennis and you search for his fish, because he has this little fish that's got a little floating body. And then basically he's tied these engineered muscles onto either side. And then he's got electric stimulators on either side of the muscles. And so all he does is he has an actuator that turns and it flips back and forth between which muscle was contracting. And you can see this fish swim around as it goes. So there are little things like that that are out there. And it was really cool stuff.
That does sound cool. Kind of freaky, but very interesting for sure.
Yeah, and there's another guy who's at Harvard who does these cool things where he's got these, he takes muscle cells and he patterns them onto these little deformable little sheets. And so what happens is he can actually then send an electrical signal through a liquid, and he can make the little sheets walk or swim or do whatever activity he wants them to do. So you can do these things using muscles, and you can do it using just these muscle cells that you would create in a dish. And the idea had originally been that this would be a great way to power space flight or something else where you need a motor, but if it breaks, it would be really good if the motor could fix itself, because that's one of the things that muscle does, is it fixes itself.
Very cool. Onto maybe what you've been studying in your expertise, and that's with health and nutrition. Both with exercise and what you eat. Can we get into a little bit of that? What are some of the big picture ideas that you could tell everybody about what you need to do to stay healthy with that and foods to eat? I know that's a very, very broad question.
Yeah, it's a broad question. And one of the big issues is that people get really, very possessive about their diets. It's a very almost religious experience for many people, because if a diet works for you, you think it's going to work for everybody. And so what we know about most diets in the short run is that it's mostly about balancing how much intake you have versus how much output you have, how much muscle activity you have. All right. And that's the simple balance of it. But then when you get down to it and you look into a much longer term idea, we've been asking questions about do the types of things that you eat. So the macronutrients, fat, carbohydrate, and protein, if you eat differing amounts of them, does that affect your longevity, your muscle function, and other things? And when we did one of the first mouse studies of longevity in this, what we did is we fed the mice. We fed the mice a diet that was either a normal diet, so that's based on the ADA, so the American Diabetes Association diet. We fed a low carbohydrate version, or we fed what's called a ketogenic diet, where there's almost no carbohydrate. And because we were doing it in mice, you actually have to decrease the amino acids as well. And what we found when we did these diets is that the low carbohydrate diet, even though that each animal every day got the exact same number of calories, the low carbohydrate diet actually increased longevity of the animals a little bit by about 6%. And the ketogenic diet actually increased the lifespan of the animals by 13%. So it's a significant increase in lifespan by shifting the diet. And largely this is because of the fact that that mice, 8 out of 10 mice die from cancer. And so what a ketogenic diet can do is it can decrease some of the molecular signals that are involved in cancer development. And so that is telling us something interesting and important, but it's maybe not super applicable to humans. The one part that's maybe more applicable to humans is that we found two interesting findings of these animals who had been on a ketogenic diet for a long time. The first one was that their neurocognitive function, the way that their brain worked, was actually better than the ones who had been on the ADA diet. And the second thing was the way that their muscle worked was better than those who had been on the normal or the classic ADA diet. And so what we're studying now is we're trying to study whether, and there's good evidence that there's actually extremely good evidence that endurance exercise can improve your brain function as well. And so now it looks like endurance exercise and a ketogenic diet are doing two things that are very similar to our bodies. And part of it, it might be that it's increasing the mitochondria that we have in our muscles. And part of it could be that it's shifting the which substrate we use. So we use more fat when we're endurance trained. We use more fat as a fuel when we're eating a ketogenic diet. And so what we're thinking and what we're trying to test right now is whether the changes that are happening in the muscle, are those required for the changes that happen in the brain? So by improving the mitochondria in the muscle, are we actually doing something that improves the function of the brain? Because a few years ago, some scientists discovered this metabolite of one of the amino acids, and it's called chiorenin. And what chiorenin is it's normally just fine, The problem is when it gets to the brain, it gets into the brain and it can become something called quinolinic acid. And quinolinic acid is a neurotoxin. And so when our muscles have a lot of mitochondria, we turn chiurenin into chiurenic acid. So it can't get across into the blood brain. It can't get across the blood-brain barrier, can't get into the brain, and it can't form quinolinic acid. And so what we think is important for the ketogenic diet is the same thing that we get when we exercise, when we do endurance exercise, is that it improves the mitochondria that we have in our muscle, and that actually improves our brain function by having this indirect effect of clearing out this neurotoxin. And I know that a lot of people, at least right now, and maybe when you're listening to this, things will have changed, but when people have now been in shelter in place and their activity levels have gone down, what many people will be experiencing is that they're going to also be noticing changes in their brain function. So their brain is going to, they're going to get depressed more easily, and they're going to not learn and remember as well as when they were active. And we think all of these things are connected by how well your mitochondria work in your muscles.
That's so cool that's connected. At least that's what the evidence seems to show, hey?
Exactly. So there's a good amount of evidence that's starting to come out that depression can be treated very well with endurance exercise. And again, that seems to correlate with this metabolite chiurenin.
I don't want to make a broad statement, but that's not all types of depression, just in like some cases, or are they finding that in many cases it does help?
In many cases of depression, exercise is as effective as talk therapy and pharmacological treatments combined.
One follow-up question before we move on. When you say endurance exercise, what do you mean by that? Just for people who maybe are not active at all, what does that mean, endurance exercise?
Yeah, so endurance exercise is basically any exercise that increases your heart rate for a period of time. And what we're trying to do, when we're talking about this, there's really two types of endurance exercise. You can go out at a relatively easy pace for a long period of time, or you can go out and get yourself breathless for a shorter period of time, rest a little bit, go and get breathless again and rest a little bit. So it can be as easy as a walk for somebody who is, especially somebody who is a little bit older. The easiest way to figure it out is to figure out your resting heart rate. And you can do that by just taking the kind of the old simple way, which is taking your age minus that from 220, and now you've got your maximum heart rate. So that's what your maximum is. You can figure out your resting heart rate by just when you wake up in the morning, just taking your heart rate, just feeling your pulse and looking at your watch and counting the number of heartbeats in a minute or in 10 seconds, even doing the math and coming up with, so you're going to come up with a number like maybe 60 or 70 as you're resting. And maybe if you're me, you're 170 as your maximum. So if I have 70 as my resting and I have 170 as my maximum, what I want to do is, so I've got 100 beats between the two. So in a long, slow endurance exercise, I would want to get my heart rate up to 40% of the difference. So I would want it to increase 40 beats per minute. So I'd want it to go up to about 110 beats per minute. And that's something that's relatively easy to do with a walk. Mm-hmm. And that I could do for 30 minutes. I could do it for 10 minutes, three times a day. Anything that you're doing there is going to be good when you get it up there. If you want to do some of the shorter ones where your heart rate is higher, now what you want to do is you want to be going over about 80 to 85%. And that's not what we'd start with. We'd start with something that you would feel comfortable with. People get out and they do it for a while. But a lot of people like these shorter bouts of higher intensity work. But of course, for any of these things, you go to your doctor first and make sure that you're healthy enough to do it.
Right. Good advice. It's also interesting. Everybody right now, like currently as we're talking, we are all inside. And if you're used to going to the gym, gyms are all closed. So people's routines have definitely been interrupted.
Exactly. And with that,
big time.
I had sent out something by Twitter that basically was a recent New England Journal of Medicine article that showed that it was a correlative article. It basically put accelerometers onto a bunch of people. So that just measures how much walking you do. And if you were somebody who walked 2,000 to 3,000 steps a day, you had, I think it was a fourfold higher likelihood of dying than somebody who walked 10,000 steps a day. And so there is good evidence that not only is your brain function affected by long periods of inactivity, but your lifespan and your quality of life go down as well.
I think about that every day, like where I live, and people who follow Bunsen know we live on a farm. So we are pretty much unaffected by the shelter in place, because where we could go, we can still go now, right? Like I would take my Bunsen for a ski or a snowshoe, and that's totally unaffected. But I know people that live in the big cities, that's not the same for them at all. So when this podcast airs, it'll be really interesting if some of the areas have opened up in both the United States and Canada. One of the things we always ask our guests about is a pet story, and we kind of heard some of your dogs talking to you.
Yeah.
Do you have a pet story you could share with our guests? It's something that everybody that listens to the podcast that kind of brings us all together with our love of animals.
So we have two dogs, 65 and 85 pounder. We have one dog because she's smart and she's very good. And then we have another dog because he's beautiful and he lacks a little bit in the smart component. And probably the best story about him is we were going out on our morning run, and we go along this route along a little arboretum here in Davis. And he's you know, classically run off leash with a collar that can bring him back if he goes too far. And he got a little bit excited by a cat that was in this area. And the cat was in the area because that area is filled. That happens to be the cactus garden.
Oh, no.
And so the cat knew the cactus garden was there, and the dog really didn't know that the cactus garden was there. So, he went full on into a barrel cactus. We came home, and I realized that he had done this. I knew that he was limping, and so we stopped, and I thought he just had something in his foot. I took out one thorn as we were coming back, or one spine. And then when we got home, I realized he had them all throughout his face and his chest and his legs. And I basically sat there for about an hour and a half, and I took out 162 spines out of his skin.
Oh, no.
And about 2 days before that, we had just got a new refrigerator, and my daughter, who was young at the time, she wanted us to save it so that she could build a fort. And she had just finished building the fort the day before and put her like little stuff in there so that she could go in there and have her privacy. And all that happened was, after I took out all the spines, he went in there and curled up and didn't move for like 2 days. He was, he was not a happy camper.
What type of dog is it? Or is it a, like a rescue mix?
Well, it's a rescue, but he's a rescue. He's an Anatolian Shepherd mix. So he's a big boy. He's 85 pounds. He's got an extra dew claw. He's got all the classic, Anatolian traits.
Ah, very cool. did the dog let you take all the spines out, or was it a bit of a wrestle?
No, he was not happy. So he was like, he just sat there and looked at me with the saddest face on earth and just was like, why did you do this? And I'm like, no, you chased the cat.
Yeah, they don't know why sometimes they're in pain. What happened to me?
Oh, that's exactly.
Well, I'm glad there was a happy ending to that.
Oh, yeah.
It was a silly story, but a good ending.
He still does, you know, equally dumb things because he can't remember the fact that he had done that in the past. And
do you get out with them and exercise with them? Like, incorporate them with walks or runs?
Yeah, we actually, about 9 years ago, I think I did a TEDx talk where basically I said the key to a happy, long and healthy life is to have a Kelpie, which our other dog is a Kelpie, because anybody who knows the breed, or we didn't actually know the breed when we adopted her. We adopted her from one of the pounds, and we brought her home, and she was cute and she was running around. And we had I had a friend come up who was Australian, and he goes, you got a Kelpie there, mate. And he was like, I had no idea what he's talking about, but you go online and you search in Wikipedia and there it is, Kelpie. And it says about, you know, a quarter of the way down the page, this animal is not suited for a sedentary lifestyle.
Oh no.
And so we learned that that dog needed about 4 miles of activity a day to not destroy the house. So I did a TEDx talk because, as we've been saying, exercise is important for increasing longevity and all of these things. And so basically I did, if you have a Kelpie, you have to exercise a whole lot to keep it sane. Was going to increase your lifespan and all of these things. So I actually, there's, I don't know if it's the only TEDx or TED talk with a dog as the key component in it, but it's certainly out there.
That's pretty funny. In the first season of the podcast, I went through a study that looked at dog owners are much more active than people that don't have dogs. And the main reason is you have to walk them. Like a lot of breeds, like the Kelpie, like the Border Collie, they'll eat your drywall and wreck your house if you coop them up. So
yeah,
it's almost, and it's so enjoyable taking a dog for a walk too, especially.
Oh, it's outstanding. Yeah. If you're going for a run and they can be off the leash, and the pure joy of seeing them run makes your run that much easier.
Bunsen isn't a runner because he's a big Bernese Mountain dog and you're not really supposed to like sprint with them. But I take him cross country skiing and he's way faster than me. And man, that's so cool you say that, because I just love the expression on his face when he's zipping around and jumping through snow drifts and smushing his face on the snow. So
it is a wonderful joy to have him with you, because it makes it makes you realize that humans are one of the few animals in the world that don't actually like to exercise. There's this beautiful study out of Holland. It was somewhere in Scandinavia, where they just took a running wheel, like the little wheels that you put into a mouse cage, and they put it into a park. And they then put a camera on it so that they could see what happened. And sure enough, animals would come, the wild animals would come, they would run in the wheel just for fun, and then they would leave. And they would do this an extensive amount of time. And so they had animals, everything from frogs to mice to all kinds of different animals would come and just use it it was just like they were coming to a playground.
That's crazy. I love it. Well, thanks for sharing the stories about your two dogs. What are their names? The Kelpie and
the
Shepherd?
The Kelpie is Roxy and the Anatolian is Hugo.
Okay, that's adorable. Love it. One of the things we also asked our guests for is a super fact. And a super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, it really makes them think or kind of blows their mind. Do you have a super fact for us?
Yeah, probably the one thing that I always point to that people aren't really aware of is that the best predictor of your lifespan as a person is your muscle strength. So there's beautiful studies that show that if you're in the strongest third of the population, you're half as likely to die between the ages of 40 and 60. If you're in the strongest third of the population, there was a 45 year study done on Hawaiians where they followed them at midlife. If you were in the strongest third of the population, you are 2.5-fold more likely to make it to 100 years of age than if you weren't in the strongest third of the population. So there's a number of different things that show that this truism that's out there, only the strong survive, is actually a literal truism. So really, our quality of life, but even the length of our life is determined by how much muscle mass we have and how strong we are.
Wow. So what was the metric for strength? Like, did they get people to do some bench presses or squats or?
But it's everything from, they've used hand grip strength is one thing, but most of them have used leg press strength. So they get into a leg press machine and they see how much weight they can lift. And if you can lift more weight with your legs, and again, because we're bipedal, the legs are super important for us. And so if you lift more weight with your legs, you're actually, that's a very, very strong predictor for how long you're going to live.
Wow. So you're saying I shouldn't skip leg day.
You shouldn't skip leg day. No, no skip leg day, because then you become a reverse teeter totter. You basically fall over all the time because you had the big upper body and small little mini lower body.
And one of the things we were talking about before the podcast that kind of goes past, goes with your super fact is that as people age, how they stay healthy has to change a bit, including what we eat. Can we kind of like delve into that a bit before we end the interview?
Sure. So basically what we know, so there's a lot of data. And again, a lot of this data is good data coming out of Canada, and a lot of it comes from McMaster and University of Toronto. So there's a guy at University of Toronto called Dan Moore, who's a really good young scientist who studied basically a little bit of how much of different things that we need to eat in order to keep our muscle strong and big and strong. And so what he's found is that in young people, when they eat about 0.25 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight, so a quarter of a gram of protein per kilogram of body weight, what they find is that that's the maximum amount you could have in a meal and still be building your muscle. The interesting thing that happens as you get older is it actually takes more protein to have the same effect on building your muscle as it did when you were younger. So instead of 0.25 grams per kilogram body weight, you actually have to increase the protein to 0.4 grams per kilogram body weight.
Wow, that's almost doubled, hey?
Yeah, so you're getting like a 60% increase in the amount of protein that you should take in, even though your body is getting smaller. And even though you're hopefully either maintaining your mass or you may be, there's possibilities that as you get older, you could lose some mass. And so really, that's different than what happens in reality, because a lot of times people go to their doctor and they say, oh, you've got cholesterol issues, so you shouldn't eat red meat, or you've got this, you shouldn't have milk, or you've got, or when they retire, they get onto a fixed income and the most expensive nutrient is protein. And so what you end up doing is you end up eating less protein as you get older, when in fact you actually need more. And so it's not that you need more calories, it's just that you need a higher proportion of your calories should come from protein in order to still maintain your muscle mass. And so that's really important as people get older. That's a key thing to keep in mind for healthy aging. And again, Professor Stuart Phillips at McMaster University has written a couple of nice papers on kind of how to age gracefully and what you need as far as the amount of protein that you need in your diet. And then again, the types of exercise that you do maybe change as well. As we get older, we tend to get stiffer. And again, that's part of what we study is that we study this idea that it's important that our muscles are big and strong, but it's also important that our connective tissue works, like our tendons and our ligaments. And so a lot of times that we do things, we really focus on doing things that are for our muscle or for our heart. So when we go out for a run, that's great for our heart. When we lift weights, that's great for our muscle, but we don't necessarily always do things that are great for our tendons and our ligaments. And we would just exercise a little bit differently for those tissues. And so the difference is that, you know, if I'm going to go out and exercise for my heart, if I go out and I exercise for 30 minutes, my heart is getting a good stimulus for all 30 minutes. But my tendons and ligaments really stopped responding to the exercise about 10 minutes into the exercise. So if I'm trying to exercise for my heart, or sorry, for my tendons, ligaments, or bones, I actually don't need as big an amount of exercise. I just need short bouts of exercise. And so that's one thing. And then the other thing that's important is that we still want to keep that muscle mass. And what we want to do is we want to make sure that at least a few times a week, and this actually, if anything, the number of times that you have to do your strength training actually goes up as you get older. And it's not that you want to lift heavy, heavy weights, but what you want to do is you want to make sure you go until you can't go anymore. And so what we're learning about is that if you want a muscle to be big, you want to train until failure. That just means that you can't possibly, if you're doing a push-up, you can't possibly push yourself up off the ground anymore. And if you get to that, that's basically, you know, Stu Phillips explains it as wringing water out of a washcloth. If you go and you wring the water out of the washcloth once and you squeeze really hard and you get most of the water out, if you go back and you do it again or you do it a third time, you maybe get one or two drops the second and third time, but most of what you got was from that first time. So if you go to failure, you only have to do it one time. So if I do push-ups and I can do 12 push-ups And every day I get down and I do 12 pushups, or I do as many pushups as I can till I can't possibly push myself up anymore. That's all I need in order to grow my muscles bigger and stronger. And so I don't need to lift huge amounts of weights, but I need to go until I can't lift it anymore.
That's interesting.
So if, especially at a time like this where we don't have access to a gym, or if you're in a position like yourself where you're out in the country and you don't have as much access to a gym, you don't need all of the equipment. All you need to be able to do is find ways that you can do a pushing exercise, do a pulling exercise, and then do an exercise like a squat or something else that's, or a lunge that works your legs. And if you just do those three exercises every day where you push, you pull, and you squat, or you do lunges against a load that's appropriate, that you go until you can't do it anymore, that's all you ever have to do.
So keeping it simple, but simple in the right way.
Exactly.
That's going to be, man, I'm just thinking about myself. I know it's been more of a struggle to exercise. I've gotten back on the wagon of exercising every day. And because the first bit of this lockdown, I was like, oh, well, I think I was like most people. It was just like, well, this is weird. Yep. But I think there's going to be a ton of people, and especially when this podcast airs, that will be using this advice quite literally, because they're going to be emerging with maybe a little heavier body than what went into the shelter in place.
Exactly. And the big thing is that one of the best tools that you have for working yourself out is your body itself.
That is a great message to kind of end with our chat. Keith, thanks for those tidbits. Where can people find you on social media, Keith?
So the only thing I really do is I'll do Twitter. I'm at Muscle Science. So that, I got in fairly early, so I got a good handle. So,
yeah, that's an awesome one.
so that's easy enough to find me there. And so I'll do things like I'll post everything from, you know, from really in-depth science, but a lot of it is going to be more generalized. And what I try and do is I try and make some of the more complicated, important science a little bit more accessible to the general population.
Yeah, that's awesome. It just like any type of science, it gets technical real quick, and then you lose the schmoes like me who are chemistry but not kinesiology or molecular physiology.
No, exactly. And we try and keep it easy, and we try and make analogies as much as we can.
Yeah, I love it. That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us on the podcast about health, nutrition, exercise, and the exciting science that you did kind of in your career and the stuff that you're working on now. That's great. Thanks so much for chatting with us.
Thank you a lot for having me. It's been really good. It's nice to be able to talk both science and dogs.
All right. Well, you take care.
All right.
All right.
Well, stay safe, everybody, and enjoy. And thank you very much.
Have a good one. Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN 10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Sciences for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have Liz Button with me again. This is round two, isn't it, Liz?
Yes, it is. I'm very excited. Hopefully I can get it right this time.
Now, how are you doing with all of the COVID issues in the world?
It's tough. I've been at home teaching remotely since the last day I stepped on campus was March 17th. So it's been a couple of months. We've been trying to keep things status quo, just kind of sitting in front of computers now instead of sitting in front of a classroom. But it's getting difficult, you know, especially with all the students with kids who have been out of school just as long. So they're trying to homeschool and work and go to school. So it's tough.
And you are a professor at ECPI University. You teach psychology.
Yes. I've been picking up a lot of classes recently because everybody's kind of going online and more people are actually going back to school, we're finding, since there's not much else they can do.
Being that you're somebody who's all about mental health, what are a couple things that you've done during COVID to keep yourself, you know, in good mental state?
I'm really a list maker. So I've made a huge list of everything I want to do around my house, and I've just been tackling everything. And recently I finally got to the outside, which is a really big mistake because I am not an outdoorsy person and I cannot identify plants. And as a result, for the past 2 weeks, I've been covered in poison ivy.
Oh,
no. For the very first time. Oh, it's awful.
I don't even think that stuff grows in Alberta.
Oh, you're so lucky.
No, I don't think it does.
Oh, yeah,
I've never seen it before in my life. I know about it from movies and stuff like that. So, does it give you like a crazy bad rash? Were you like crazy itchy?
Yeah, I look almost kind of like I've been burned on my legs. No. Like you can see where the oil got on there and I've got these like kind of big spots and I'm trying not to scratch, but you know, it's hard to resist that impulse.
That's gross. It's just different flora on the East Coast and a little bit south of us, hey?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also interesting because my neighbors were helping and we all touched the same stuff. They've got nothing.
Wow.
So, you know, lucky me.
Just lucky or unlucky, yeah. Crazy. Right. Well, speaking of lists, I've got a list here of woo or wow. And are you ready to get going with the trivia?
Sure.
The category this week is about human endurance, both psychological and physical. So you might be able to get some of these. I was thinking the other day because you got some training on the psych side.
Okay.
Because our guest this week specializes in exercise biology. I thought I'd throw some. Yeah. It was a great interview. All right. So for people at home that are new to Woo or Wow, I read three statements. Two of them are fake. They're woo. And one of them is true. It's a wow. And your job, Liz, you know, you have to find the true statement.
Okay. I'm ready.
Okay. All right. You ready? First statement. When American astronaut Scott Kelly returned to Earth after 340 days aboard the ISS, he broke the American record for staying in space. However, Valery Polyakov, who between 1994 and 1997 crushed that because it was around 740 days, which was double Scott's record.
Wow. I can't even imagine being in space that long.
Yeah, Scott. We know about Scott Kelly up in Canada. Like his big journey in space made news for us. Anyways, that's the first statement. Okay.
Okay.
All right, second statement. In 2013, New Zealander Kim Allen made an attempt at breaking a continuous running record set by American Pam Reed. Despite losing all of her toenails, she broke it and ran consecutively for 210 kilometers in 36 hours.
Can you translate that distance for the American here?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I have no idea. It's like 130 miles.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Sorry.
I'm so sorry. I forgot.
Public school 130, system.
Okay. 130 miles. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So there's that one. That's a ways to go. And the last statement. In 1965, a high school student named Randy Gardner, under the supervision of Stanford University, set a record that has not been touched to this day. He stayed awake without the use of stimulants for 11 straight days.
Okay. I do love stuff that comes out of Stanford. Okay.
Do you want me to recap or are you good?
We'll recap.
First statement. Scott Kelly broke the American record in space at 340 days, but that was crushed by Valery Polyakov, who logged about 740 days. Statement two, New Zealander Kim Allen beat the American Pam Reed's record by running for 210 kilometers or 130 miles consecutively for 36 hours. And statement number three, back in 1965, a student under the supervision of Stanford University stayed awake without stimulants for 11 straight days. Only one of these statements is true. What do you think?
Well, I think the running one, the New Zealander, is probably Woo, because 130 miles seems like an awful lot. And I don't think anybody could physically run that much, considering, you know, the original marathon with Nikkei was 26 miles and he collapsed afterwards. So I'm kind of torn between the space or the time and space and Stanford. But for the sake of my field, I'm going to go with Stanford because some crazy things have come out of there. And it is possible to stay awake for 11 days, although you will start to hallucinate and lose, you know, motor function and coordination and that kind of stuff. So 11 days straight.
Okay, final answer?
Yes.
All right, da-da-da-da, locked in. Okay, let's take a look at the second statement. The running one was a woo. And you got it right, but for the wrong reason. The New Zealander broke the record and ran for 310 miles consecutively. That took her 86 hours.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that insane?
I couldn't run to the end of my driveway without getting winded. I can't imagine.
Yeah, but okay. Like it just wrecked her. Like she did lose all of her toenails. She was hallucinating. Like it was just about killed her. So not something you should probably do. Crazy.
No,
right?
I'll be all right. Oh yeah.
Okay. So we're down to two statements. You thought the first statement about space was a woo. Mm-hmm. And you are correct. You're right. It is a woo.
Yes.
You've won. Good job, Liz.
Yay.
Now it is true. Valerie did beat Scott Kelly's record, but he didn't stay in space for 740 days. That's more than 2 years, I believe. He stayed in space for 438 days. Still a long time in outer space.
Yes.
And you are right. Crazy stuff comes out of Stanford. And this poor guy did stay awake for 11 straight days, and he did good to about day 8. And then you are absolutely correct. He had a bunch of very terrible mental and physical consequences for staying awake that long. Hallucinations, paranoia. And he lost his ability to have long and short-term memory at the end. He couldn't remember anything for more than about 10 seconds. So because of that, they've never duplicated the study.
Slightly unethical, but I think what's interesting is, like, when we talk about, you know, sleep deprivation, once you go to sleep and you wake up the next day, everything kind of seems to go back to normal.
Yeah, you know what? That's so interesting you say that. I've got a little footnote here. I was going to talk about that, but that's exactly it. This guy in 2 days was back 100% normal. I think he said he needed about a nut. Like he slept for a while and needed a second type sleep. And he was totally normal. Everything went away. Yeah, that's crazy.
The brain's amazing.
Man, I was never one to pull all nighters. I need my sleep too much. I've never done, like, even though I've been through some grueling science classes in my science degree, I didn't study all night. I know a lot of people that went to school would pull all nighters, and some video gamers would game all night till the wee hours of the morning or never go to sleep. I couldn't do that. Did you ever have to do that, Liz?
I did for a couple classes in college.
It was a
terrible mistake. You don't retain information anymore. You're just reading words on a paper and might as well just go to bed. Sleep is a fabulous memory aid.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's what I said. By the time I got to like maybe midnight, I was like, I'm not learning anything. Time to sleep.
Yep.
Well, 2 for 2. You're batting 100. That's awesome. Good job.
Thanks.
All right. Well, you know, it was so great to talk to you again and hear your input about being a professor during COVID. We're dealing with that same thing in Canada with my wife and I are both teachers. The future is really uncertain due to this little tiny virus.
Mm-hmm. And like, it just kind of highlights, you know, the differences even in the same areas, you know, the county where some people can afford to have technology and put their kids online and some people can't. So we got a lot of kids falling behind. So the governments have a huge responsibility.
People are differently abled by economic status for sure when things like this happen.
Yeah, and I worry about the special education kids who aren't getting what their IEPs require. So
yeah, exactly. I guess the main thing is to keep yourself safe too, Liz. And if things open up, wish you the best of luck in September, but hopefully we chat before then.
Yes, definitely. So good luck with you guys and all you figure out for
school year.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, good job.
Okay, thank you.
So it's that time again. It's 8:02 and it's time for the mailbag with me, Adam. So we haven't done the mailbag in a while. You might have forgotten. The mailbag is when we answer questions on Twitter. So the first question is coming in is from Shona Schneider. To Dad Guy and Mummy Fave, which online science lessons, activities, or tricks resulted in the best student engagement? Because September. So I'm going to get my mom here, who taught science and math for her kids during the whole quarantine teachy thing. And yeah, she'll give you a bit of insight.
That is a great question. I did a whole bunch of different online interactive simulations that I thought would be very interesting for my students. Here in Alberta, we have something called Learn Alberta, which has these interactive sites on there. But what I really found very effective was something called FET, P-H-E-T. And the website is fet.colorado.edu. And they're interactive simulations for both science and math. So things for physics, chemistry, earth science, biology, and math. And there's over 150 interactive simulations that you can choose. And it's actually quite cool. They have some teacher-submitted lessons as well, so you can have a look through those. I created my own Google form asking questions for the students to answer. So it was really quite simple to have them do a simulation and then a quick check-in with a Google form. And sometimes I had the Google form self-marking, so they got their results right away, or other times that I had to review the Google form. But that's what I found that had the most engagement for science. Adam, you did math this semester at home. What did you find engaging?
Okay, so what I found engaging with math and social studies, well, mostly math because social is, I don't really like it. But what I found engaging in math is my teacher. He's very energetic and he loves what he does. So he's like, hey, and he's in French, so he says, hey, my friends, because he thinks that we're his friends, which I think that we are. So the best way to engage your students in your lessons is to actually engage yourself with your lessons. So instead of going like, this is what you have to do, learn it, and then we'll do a quiz at the end of the week, you should be like, hey, try this out, and if you don't like it, do some other things that are pretty fun.
So it's the teacher piece that's really important.
Yes. Yes, of course it is. You can't bore yourself with your own subject, is kind of what I'm trying to say.
So that's what you might consider for September.
The second question comes from Benjamin Walton. What's Danger Noodle's backstory? And if you don't know, Danger Noodle is my snake. Aklis's backstory is that when I was in grade 5 or grade 6, I really wanted a snake. Why did I want a snake? They're super scary and yada, yada, yada. They're actually, I would agree, for the most part, for a lot of people, they are scary and people don't really like them. But for people like me, I like snakes and reptiles. I think that they're cute. They have little snouts like dogs, but I find them cute in a different way. It's not like a kitten. A kitten is like, oh, I want to pet it. A snake is more like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Okay, no. When you brought that snake home, I was like, oh, perfect. I can hold her. And you told me no, that she had to go be relaxed in her hidey hole so she wasn't scared and wouldn't bite people.
Yes. When she first got home, she could not be picked up because she was stressed from the move. She was in a car for like, I don't know, an hour, because we got her from a place in Calgary called J&J Reptiles, and they're very good for reptilian creatures and picking up food.
Beaker.
They're good for reptilian and picking up food and such. I really wanted a snake. It took 2 years for me to convince my mom to get me a snake. So yeah, it was grade 6, I think. That's her backstory, is that I wanted a snake, I thought they were cool,
God, Beaker,
and we got one, and I'm very happy, so, yeah.
I'm just honestly very glad that Aklis does not eat crickets. Our eldest son had bearded dragons, and that was a whole big thing where they had the crickets in the container, and they would be jumping, and I just couldn't deal. It's like, ah! Every time, screaming, trying to feed the bearded dragons.
The next and last question is from David Smith. What is Beaker's favorite toy besides Bunsen, of course? Dad, would you like to answer this question?
Yep, my question's really quick. It's going to be a twofer. So Beaker's favorite toy is this little lion thing that she got when we brought her home. I guess they had the scent of her litter mates on it, so she really likes it. She plays tug-of-war with it with Bunsen, and sometimes Bunsen tries to steal it from her. But Bunsen doesn't really like toys, so he's kind of a troll that way. But you know, the bigger troll is anything that Bunsen has, Beaker wants. So Beaker's favorite toy is anything and everything that Bunsen has. She just follows him around, and if Bunsen has something, Beaker's like, I want that. And one of the toys that it seems to be the thing they play and they fight over the most, well, not really fight over, Beaker tries to take, is the opera squirrel. And there's lots of questions on Twitter about what the heck the opera squirrel is. It's think of a stereotypical woman opera singer, and it's a squirrel. That's literally what the opera squirrel is. And we got it from BarkBox in some kind of like opera-themed box. And that's what it is. Behind, you might be hearing some commotion in this because Bunsen has a treat and Beaker is really wanting this treat. Even though Beaker already had a treat, she wants Bunsen's treat too.
Bunsen's all done eating the treat, they're just biting each other.
I know. She's a little bit over the top sometimes.
It's time to close up the mailbag for this episode of the podcast. I'll see you next time, but that's been me. Bye-bye.
And that's the end of another podcast episode for this week. And thanks to Dr. Keith Barr, who talked to us about exercise and exercise physiology and biology. That's super interesting and super timely, so we can all think about eating a little bit better and getting in a little bit better shape and the science behind it. Next week, the podcast will have been on the air for an entire year, and we will have some special shout-outs to patrons who have been with us for an entire year. But right now, let's give a shout out to our top tier patrons who make the podcast possible.
Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Shelby Leggett, Daniel Fry, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Judith Morton, Karen Beth St. George, Catherine Lynch, Kathleen Zerker, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Ben Rathert, Liz Button, and Rebecca Rutherford.
Thanks so much, patrons. Let's end with Bunsen's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.